Welcome to TWiL, the Week in Health Law, the podcast of record for the discussion of health law and policy. We're recording this episode on October 1st, 2015. I'm Nicholas Terry, a law professor at Indiana University McKinney School of Law in Indianapolis. My co-host is...
Frank Pasquale, a law professor at the University of Maryland's Francis King Carey School of Law in Baltimore, Maryland.
So today we welcome Kirk Nara. Mr. Nara is a partner in the DC law firm Wiley Rhine. He's a Harvard Law School graduate, and he's chair of the firm's privacy practice and also the co-chair of the firm's healthcare group. In 2014, Chambers USA, in making up a list of the nation's top-tier privacy attorneys, noted about Kirk, quote, "the guy you need to call." So we did. Welcome, Kirk.
Thank you very much. I'm always glad somebody reads those things.
Well, let me start by wishing you both happy ICD-10 day. From where you're sitting, are there any signs of the apocalypse?
Yeah, nothing yet. I think it's going to take at least a couple hours, but I do think that's going to be a challenge.
I was forwarded today a letter that a health system has prepared for its patients in case there were waiting room delays. Of course, something that never occur. And apparently this letter is to be given out in the case of any delays that possibly could have anything to do with coding to patients, explaining that it's not the hospital's fault.
Well, that's a nice excuse, actually. To say.
That's right.
Those delays we've had for years are now because of the transition.
Let's start with a case recently decided by the Third Circuit. It's not a health case, or at least not obviously a health case. It's the Wyndham Hotels security case. And this is getting a lot of press, a lot of commentary. I've been writing about it for the last few weeks in trying to paint a picture of how the FTC is developing a common law of privacy and security, working off some of the work that folks like Dan Solov has been doing. Wyndham's, Kirk, is this a game changer, even in the health space? Or is it where it is procedurally now, just another small step in what may be a never-ending piece of litigation?
I think Wyndham is a really important case. I think the game changer element would have been if the decision had gone the other way. I mean, what the decision did was basically supported, you know, in a it's not a definitive decision because it's not a Supreme Court decision and it's the first of its kind, but it's a Federal Circuit Court decision that says the FTC does in fact have the ability to engage in enforcement activity related to data security standards. Now, the FTC has been doing that for, I'm going to say, a decade, not quite a decade, I suppose, and certainly over that point of time, period of time through its enforcement, has built up a common law of data security. The Third Circuit could have put a stop to that. They didn't. So it's important by sort of what it didn't do. And what that does is it gives the FTC, you know, even more support for what it's doing. It may have an impact, frankly, on the legislative debate. It lets Congress off the hook a little bit, in the sense that if the FTC was kicked out of this area, Congress would have really been pushed to act. So very important case. Important thing to watch, because there will be other, you know, it was a close enough call, I think, when you read the opinion, that other people may challenge it. You know, you could have an interesting law school debate about what would have happened if instead of Wyndham challenging this now, BJ Wholesale had challenged it 10 years ago when they were the first company to underdo this before there was really a built-up standard. So lots of interesting things to watch. And for the healthcare industry, I think the issue is not the Wyndham case, but it's sort of a follow-up case involving a company called LabMD, which raises the same issue that Wyndham did in general about the FTC. But LabMD was a HIPAA-covered entity, and the FTC has gone after them as well. So that's really the one to watch for the healthcare industry.
And I am sure that Nick will have some follow-up on LabMD and some of those issues in terms of the allocation of responsibility between, say, HHS and FTC. I was at a joint workshop of FTC and HHS back in 2010 on personal health records, and I remember it was a very difficult, interesting topic. The one question, though, I want to raise in response to Wyndham and your excellent discussion of it, Kirk, is, you know, I was listening to this interesting podcast on a book called Cyberphobia at the LSE about sort of general policies with respect to security. And I'm wondering, do you think that the FTC's approach of sort of keeping things flexible, is that ideal because it effectively is promoting diverse security practices, diverse business ways? Or do you think that essentially, eventually the solution is going to be one best way of securing these devices and securing personal data?
I guess I like the FTC's approach in a lot of ways. It makes things easier and harder. I mean, I think a standard that said every company must do the following 12 things exactly this way would be a bad result. The HIPAA security rule clearly doesn't follow that. I think they were very smart to say that. There are companies all over the map in terms of what they do and how they do it and what they need to do and how their workforce is and everything. So I guess I like the more flexible standards of the FTC, which I guess you'd argue is even more flexible than the HIPAA security rule. The challenge, however, is that it really, I mean, the hardest single question I get asked by any client these days is, am I in compliance with the HIPAA security rule or with the FTC standards? Because to some extent, the answer is you don't know until it's tested. And that's a frustrating place to be in. But I think what the FTC is doing, and I think this is true for HHS as well with the security rule, is they're not really nitpicking around the edges. They're going after companies that have had major problems and haven't really done, even a reasonable job of going after that. Now, obviously, I know companies challenge that, and I think that's the history. So you're sort of dependent on the FTC being responsible and reasonable, which I think they generally have been, and I think HHS generally has been as well. But I prefer a more flexible standard just because I think a more aggressive and a more definitive standard would actually create its own problems with making our system just work well.
Got it. No, I completely see that point of view, and I've also been following closely Solov and Hartzog's work in the common law development here. I think it's very important and a wise strategy. One thing also, there are some critics out there who say, well, is this, non-law law? What do these guidelines exactly mean? Why isn't the FTC trying to develop something with the force and effect of law that's more concrete? But on the other hand, I guess the consolation you can sometimes offer to the clients is to say, well, it's in the very nature of an interpretive rule as opposed to a legislative rule that it can be challenged when it is enforced. And I imagine eventually, if the FTC ever gets to the point of going after more marginal cases, we're going to see that type of challenge within the agency itself. But I guess what I'm hearing from you, Kirk, is that because there's just maybe so much potential enforcement activity, the FTC can focus on the most egregious cases, and perhaps as long as it's focused on the more egregious cases, it might not get around to developing, more nuanced distinctions for the closer calls. I don't know.
Well, that's perhaps putting more words in my mouth than I had intended. I mean, I think
okay.
I would look at it a little differently. I obviously there are things like resource issues. I don't think that's really. I mean, it's not irrelevant for the FTC, but I think the FTC is not. I mean, is they've spelled out a fairly general standard that talks about reasonable and appropriate, and so I don't think they have either the interest or the inclination in going after the judgment calls on what's reasonable. They want to go after situations where they see something that they don't believe is reasonable, meaning it's not close to the line. And I think that's, again, I think that's a smart way to do it. I think you can distinguish how the FTC has acted and how HHS has acted in the privacy and security space, contrasted, for example, with what you often tend to see in the healthcare fraud area, where you see very aggressive enforcement action with enormous financial consequences for things that look like almost nothing. And you just don't see that in the privacy and security area. You may see that if we start to talk about some of the lawsuits. I mean, I think the class action bar doesn't care about nuance. They're interested in just, something bad happened, therefore we're going to sue before we even knew what was going on. I don't think the government's been acting that way, and I don't think they should act that way. I think, but at the same time, I think the goal, what the FTC is doing with its effort is it's basically telling every company that you have to do something reasonable and appropriate in this area. And so what it's, you know, you can make the same argument with things like data breach notification statutes, where you could argue that the true goal of those provisions is not necessarily enforcement of the law. It's to get everybody up to speed on what kinds of things the law is trying to encourage.
So I think it's interesting, both in LabMD that you brought up, which was sort of the first in this sort of healthcare line of FTC complaints, that both in that case and in Wyndham, of course, the respondents complained that FTC didn't have a published set of definitive rules and that they couldn't just go into this sort of common law world, and in both cases FTC prevailed. You mentioned the class action issues. I guess this must be the other area that your clients are particularly worried on, as you just alluded to. Do things seem to be, from their perspective at least, getting a little bit worse? I mean, I think a lot of people kind of looked at the Target case as being a bit of an outlier, but now we have the Seventh Circuit in the Neiman Marcus case, and I think there is considerably more concern out there with regard to these big breaches.
Well, I think there's clearly concern. I mean, it's a bit of a funny environment, because what you have is you have more and more cases being filed, you know, routinely and reflexively and automatically and, you know, frankly, duplicatively, even though most of the court decisions have, you know, struck down the claims. And so it's a funny split. And I think the outliers that you're talking about, what they're doing is they're sort of giving sort of faint hope to each of these new cases. And I think the courts have still been very firm, and I've actually been a little surprised at this, but they've been very firm on the principle that a data breach in and of itself is not something that leads to a claim for damages. You have to have some kind of real injury. Now, maybe that's an important line that where we distinguish what the FTC can do and what a plaintiff's class action can do. I mean, the FTC can go after somebody because they had bad practices. It doesn't matter whether those practices resulted in a harm or not. The lawsuit process seems designed for damage inquiries, and the courts, again, have been pretty firm on that. The plaintiff's bar continues to be very creative in coming up with new kinds of claims. I always joke a little bit, this is probably relevant for you guys who are law professors. You know, people are going back to their first year torts casebook, you know, something you haven't looked at since your first year of law school, and thought, well, let's see what's on page 62. Let's try to file that kind of a claim. And you get a little bit of a sense of that reading these complaints, but, you know, it's clearly true that in most situations involving security breach, there isn't actual harm to most and maybe all of the people. Some of the outliers have been situations where a small number of people have been able to assert some kind of injury. Just because two people had a problem doesn't mean 2 million people had a problem. And I think that that's a real challenge. And frankly, if we had a situation where these class actions were successful to some extent without any injury, I mean, businesses would just be overwhelmed with those cases. And I think that would, on the whole, be a real negative for everybody.
So you made a distinction when we were talking about Wyndham and security. You made a distinction between HIPAA privacy and HIPAA security with, I think, I'm putting words into your mouth, a sense that HIPAA privacy perhaps was a little too definitive and you have to do X and Y and Z, in contrast to sort of the looser sort of common law approach of FTC or the approach of the security rule. Let's take a minute to talk about HIPAA and the health space. Have we seen all we're going to get in terms of changes to the HIPAA regulation? I mean, there's been, other than the lab results stuff, there's been nothing that I can recall since the omnibus rule. Is anything more coming out of that, or do you think we're going to be anything that we do see is going to be tending to deal with like the non-HIPAA space, where so much health data now seems to either have migrated to or is actually being created in?
Well, let's. Your question goes to the future, and I do want to go back to one point about the words in my mouth. I don't think the privacy rule is too prescriptive. I think privacy, by its nature, often lends itself to being more prescriptive. I mean, you don't want to say you have an individual right to your records as long as the doctors give it to you in a reasonable and appropriate time. They said it's, what they put a number of days in there, and I think it's more prescriptive in that sense, and I think it's easier to figure out if you're complying, but I think that's the nature of the beast. Now, in terms of going forward, I think absent some new law that forces the Office for Civil Rights to redo significant pieces of HIPAA, and there is a piece of law out there floating around that may require them to do that. We'll come back to that in a second. I think absent that, there are a handful of leftovers from the high-tech rules, the high-tech law, that seem to be sort of out in limbo, the most important one being the HIPAA accounting rule, where Congress mandated a change. HHS came out with what, in my personal view, is the single worst proposed rule they've ever done in this area. I generally think HHS does a very good job in this area. I think the accounting rule proposal was a disaster, and it seems to have just been buried, and it doesn't seem to have been moving at all. That's a potentially very significant rule that, as far as I can tell, is going nowhere. I think the only other things that are out there right now are minor tweaks and maybe some areas where we can expect some guidance, but it doesn't seem to be a priority of that regulatory agency. I'm not sure I can understand why. I remember reading in the proposal for the omnibus rule that they said they were going to make the changes required by HIPAA, as well as making other changes based on their, 10 years of history in interpreting the rules. And then they didn't really do anything with that. They made, I always joke that they made one change based on their history of administrating the rules. And what that was to remove from coverage under HIPAA the privacy, the personal records of people that had been dead for more than 50 years, which wasn't exactly a burning issue under HIPAA. So they don't seem interested in modifying the rules. That may reflect the fact that generally I think the privacy rule works pretty well. It's almost, given that they were starting with a complete blank slate, it's actually very impressive that they were able to come up with a rule that has generally worked so well. But I don't think we're going to see a lot of significant change unless there's a law that tells them they have to go back in and start making changes. And if that happens, then it's possible that things get opened up more aggressively.
So what about outside of HIPAA, pure HIPAA space then, and the traditional, conventional healthcare space? Let's talk a little bit about an area that Frank and I spend quite a lot of time thinking and talking about, looking at the HIPAA free zone.
The HIPAA free zone, I like that. Well, what we're dealing with now, and I think you're right to say that this is a much more active area than modifications within the HIPAA zone. The HIPAA rule, and I always stress this to people that aren't that familiar with the rule, is the HIPAA rule is not a general medical privacy law or regulation. It is a very important privacy rule that protects certain kinds of information when it's held by certain kinds of people for certain kinds of purposes. And, the scope of the privacy rule is a bit of an accident of the history of HIPAA, which really had very little to do with privacy, essentially had nothing to do with privacy. Privacy was largely an afterthought to the primary goals of portability and standard transactions. And so you end up with a privacy rule that is confined in scope in a way that, again, makes logical sense if you sort of follow the history of the rule, but nobody would go out and start from scratch to write a privacy rule that the way we ended up with it because of HIPAA. So we've always known it's been limited. It's just that for a lot of years, we didn't care that much about the limits or the gaps because they weren't that significant. They were things like, insurance companies who are not health insurers but might have health information to do life insurance underwriting, or because you were in a car accident or something like that. They were regulated otherwise, and we just weren't that worried about it. What we've seen in the last, certainly 10 years, really exploding in the last 3 to 5 years, has been the growth of health information that is being created entirely outside of the healthcare system. Frank alluded earlier to personal health records. That was an early one. We had all kinds of websites that were, you know, community support groups and health information and things like that. Now, in the last few years, we've had all the healthcare mobile apps and the wearables and things like that. To overgeneralize a little bit, all of that development is creating healthcare information that's outside of the scope of HIPAA, because there doesn't tend to be a doctor or a hospital in the middle of that process. And that's an enormous and growing and very challenging issue, where the status quo is that you know, the activities with that data is essentially unregulated today, absent, you know, egregious things like lying to people about what you're doing. The FTC can always go after you if you lie to your customers. But if I have a great wearable device and I have a privacy notice with that wearable device that says, you understand that I can take your information and sell it to anybody I feel like for any purpose, there's no law that says you can't do that generally today.
And that does raise really difficult issues, right? Because, I mean, I was looking over Scott Peppett's work, his empirical research on whether various Fitbits or other Internet of Things-enabled devices even had privacy policies. And what he had found was that very often they didn't have privacy policies. So, you know, and I'm wondering if there might eventually develop a sort of common law of unfairness with respect to these types of devices or IoT-enabled things, particularly when they involve health data, because I just don't think that people fully understand what's going on in terms of the richness of the data sets and the ways in which they could inform all sorts of reputational intermediaries that individuals haven't even heard of yet.
No, I think that's, you know, that's one of the potential paths going forward, is that the FTC would essentially, you know, much like they did in data security and exactly like Wyndham says they did, sort of starts from scratch to develop a common law on what you can and cannot do on the privacy side of that equation. They really haven't shown that much, I don't know if interest is quite the right word, capability in that area, because I think that gets very tricky. And there aren't, you know, nobody supports bad security, right? I mean, nobody's in favor of a security breach because there's no upside to a security breach. There's lots of upsides to various kinds of activities with data where we may or may not agree on, you know, whether the upside is balanced by a downside. But again, on security breaches, there's no balance. So I think the government in a lot of places, not just the FTC, is very reluctant to jump in too quickly into that space, because they're concerned about limiting innovation and preventing technological advances and inhibiting technological advances and things like that. So while it's possible the FTC could do that, I don't know that that's going to happen in the short term. You know, again, other than people essentially lying in their privacy notices, which frankly, they could probably keep themselves busy dealing with cases where people have lied in their privacy notices. But I think that we're going to have a more significant debate about really what the rules are related to this. I mean, if you go back to things like fair information principles, I mean, a lot of that involves notice and choice and doesn't in and of itself really include a fairness idea. I mean, the idea is you tell people what you're doing and you give them certain kinds of choices. I think what we're finding now in the internet environment in particular, and the device area in particular, is that choice is not something that anybody realistically can utilize. And so we need to find an alternative, and we just haven't come up with that yet. But again, I think the debate is building. I think there's lots of concerns about how that data is being used. I think there's very little full and complete understanding of how it might be used. You know, one of the things that gets very interesting in the privacy space is that if I'm collecting all kinds of data about all kinds of people, and that lets me come up with a better, you know, modeling of the future, I might use that information not against the people whose data I have, but against people I've never seen before. And that creates a, you know, again, that's not really a, we can debate whether that's even a privacy issue at that point. I mean, there are clearly other laws, you know, Fair Credit Reporting Act being one, for example, where it's not the data as much as what you are able to do with it and what kinds of decisions you are able to make. And so, you know, that's another avenue that we may be looking at in this, in the internet area.
Yes, I completely agree. And that was a big theme of my book earlier this year, the chapter on reputation and new methods of creating reputation, that I'm very pleased to see both the FTC, Director of Consumer Protection, and folks at the CFPB are interested in. But one, I guess, more procedural line I wanted to follow, just going in the direction of your point about needing to think of new ways to deal with the new technologies and the inferences that they can enable. I've been following this controversy over the facial recognition, I don't know if we'd call them hearings or a public comment period or sort of the maybe a negotiated rulemaking type of model that had been going on, where there were representatives of industry and I believe 9 privacy groups that were discussing facial recognition. But then there was a bit of a blow up in that process when the privacy groups all decided that because the industry groups were not willing to budge on their initial demand that consumers should have the right, should have to give permission for face recognition, that they didn't think there was anything worth talking about at the at this process. And I'm wondering, do you think that these types of processes in general will be helpful to informing these emerging areas of law? Or do you think that, you know, we're going to just see more of these sort of irreconcilable differences between, say, the very respected privacy groups in D.C. and the industry associations that are influencing the future of regulation here?
Yeah, the policy debate in this area has been very interesting, and I actually see it as much and maybe even more in healthcare than in some of the examples that you've seen. Although another place that's coming up is in the cyber debate that's going on in Congress, which is, I think, and maybe this isn't that unusual. It's just an area that I'm more involved in than others, so I'm just seeing more of it. But you really do seem to have extremists or extreme views without there being any realistic center. And maybe what that's doing is it's mirroring, you know, the Republicans and the Democrats as well. I mean, you could make that generalization if you wanted to. But, you know, I see in the healthcare debate, I see people who are participating in the debate who are adamant about protecting privacy. And what I don't see is a group that sort of represents the average person. You know, there isn't a Patients of America group involved in lobbying on privacy issues. And so you get very extreme perspectives. And I don't, you know, one of the things that's been important, and it was very important when HHS was writing the rule, was they didn't want the privacy rules to get in the way of making our healthcare system work. I mean, information has to flow in order to make our healthcare system work, you know, which is in everyone's interest to have the healthcare system work. And they, you know, the government went out of its way when HIPAA first went into place to basically say, look, we're not trying to nail people. We want to teach. We want to educate. We want to fix problems. We want to work with you. And they meant it, and they were sincere about it, and they demonstrated that. And I think that went a long way in making that, you know, that transition to a HIPAA privacy environment, you know, work much better than it otherwise could have. If people had been scared to death about what they could do, that could have created real substantive health problems that would have overshadowed the privacy issues. And I'm not sure we've got enough people with a stake in this debate who are, you know, who want to protect privacy but still want the system to work at the same way. And so I think you're seeing that in, you know, the debate on things like facial recognition or cyber insurance, cyberspace, and some of these areas where, you know, it's become again a government versus the individual piece. We're seeing the extreme views, and we're not necessarily seeing the people who, you know, sort of want to make it all work or have it all work, you know, reasonably well.
And I'm wondering whether the sheer difficulty of the policy choices is reflected in the fact that we seem to have way more reports and studies of the issue than any kind of meaningfully proposed legislation that has any traction. I mean, if you go back to sort of 2012, we had the FIPS-inspired White House report and then the FTC report. If you go forward to 2014, we had become transfixed by big data because it wasn't yet Internet of Things time. And you had the PCAST report, you had another White House report, you had the FTC Brokers report. Then earlier this year, we have the that sort of bare draft bill from the White House. And even more recently, if you were following the HIT Policy Committee, they endorsed a report from a working group on how to deal with big data. And as we've gone through those various reports and proposals, more and more I'm worried that the only one that seems to have any kind of traction is to go with enforceable codes of conduct with a kind of a safe harbor model. And I'm entirely unconvinced that that's the right way to go. And I whether you had thoughts on that.
Well, I mean, I guess your description of the process doesn't surprise me at all, in the sense that, you know, I think that's a very normal process for how policy gets made. And frankly, I don't know what your thoughts are on you know, your confidence in Congress, but I don't really want Congress getting involved in this without having the benefit of a whole lot of information before they get involved, because I'm scared to death about what could come out of Congress. I mean, I think that, you know, we're the sort of white paper and hearings and articles and op-ed pieces and speeches, I mean, that's just how a lot of policy gets made here. And, you know, I think the codes of conduct are, you know, an interesting middle ground. I mean, when I get put in charge of all of this, which unfortunately isn't happening all that soon, I could see a bill that would come out of Congress that would essentially do something like empower the FTC to write regulations, which is sort of how we ended up with the HIPAA privacy rule. I mean, Congress, if you actually look at the HIPAA statute on privacy, it says essentially nothing about privacy. And so Congress was supposed to go back and revisit the HIPAA law and come up with its own privacy law, and it couldn't do that. And so they had built in a fallback, which was for HHS to write a reg, but you know, they didn't have any real ground rules to write the reg. I could see Congress passing a general principle privacy law and letting the FTC go write a regulation, and maybe the FTC would incorporate a lot of the ideas that are coming up in these enforceable codes of conduct, but then it would be, excuse me, an actual regulation. I personally would think that would be the overall best approach. The FTC is good at these issues, is very thoughtful about this stuff, has a lot of really smart people who I think do frankly understand the need to balance a lot of activities. They are not going to pursue privacy protection in a way that fundamentally screws up a bunch of other stuff in our systems and in our economy. So I'd be very supportive of that kind of idea. I don't want Congress writing, you know, the experience would be the high-tech law where they got into the weeds of the details of the HIPAA regulations in ways that I think were problematic. And I don't really want them doing that, particularly from scratch. So, you know, codes of conduct in my mind may be, you know, a second or third best alternative that's actually a viable option. I think the sort of FTC being given authority to regulate is a at least intermediate viable option that I think would be a little better. But, you know, there just hasn't seemed to be any traction at all in Congress on the privacy side. There was a little more on the data security side, and as I said, if the Wyndham case had gone the other way, I think Congress might have been forced to act on data security. But I think with Wyndham being in place now, they don't really have to do anything on data security because the FTC can go out and keep engaging in its practices without really needing to change.
I had a question that was sort of stepping back from our discussion of some of the details of the American landscape to a more international perspective. And it seems especially, you know, in the news this week, there have been the rumblings about potential challenges to the U.S.-EU safe harbor framework. And, you know, from a longer-term perspective, there's this general divergence of U.S. and EU privacy policies, particularly, you know, in something like the right to be forgotten, going to create a very different legal landscape in Europe than the U.S. in certain ways. And I'm wondering, Kirk, if you see this sort of drifting apart of the U.S. and EU as something that's worrying a lot of corporations that are out there, or do you think that it's something that folks feel is generally under control and they're not that concerned about?
I think it's much more, I guess, the former of your choices. They're concerned about it, and I think the most recent developments about calling into question the safe harbor with the EU have gotten people very nervous. I think it's a potentially very problematic development. And, you know, I was speaking a few minutes ago about the sort of, you know, extreme, and again, I'm overstating extreme. It's not extremists like, you know, terrorists. You know, these are just people who have very firm views and aren't really concerned about some of the other implications of that. I think what you see in some other countries with some of the folks in Europe like this is really looking at privacy without any kind of balance in any, you know, with any of the other issues that are going on. And so, you know, and it's also being driven by, you know, this, I can't say it's entirely irrational, but it's edging in that direction, concern that the government is going to start looking, you know, the U.S. government is going to start looking at everything you buy from the Gap, you know, that ships from Europe because, you know, of potential terrorism. It's just, it's not working that way, but it's driving the debate in Europe. And so, I mean, if the EU were to basically declare the Safe Harbor program invalid, it's going to be a whole lot of bad implications for all kinds of entities in the EU, in the US, in other countries, citizens all over the place. And I don't think that the regulators, you know, particularly since it's such an eclectic group of different kinds of regulators, I don't think they've really thought through the implications of that. So I think it's a very, very disconcerting development in the last few weeks.
Well, let me add my voice to that. I agree with both of you. This is an extremely important development, and it is being underplayed in conversations on this side of the Atlantic. One thing that I would add that I think maybe gets forgotten is this is not an about face by a regulatory agency or even by a political body or obviously political body. This is potentially the European Court of Justice. The stuff that came out this week on Safe Harbor was from the Advocate General, who sort of operates, it's very hard to put it in Anglo-American terms, but operates to an extent like a sort of a federal district court giving the opinion just before the Supreme Court gives their opinion. And it's highly likely that the Advocate General will be followed by the ECJ here. And remember, it was the ECJ that decided Google Spain, even while the politicians were still sort of discussing whether the right to be forgotten was going to stick in the proposed regulation. So I think that piece of the puzzle is important too. So before we let you go, Kirk, what do you think from 5,000 feet the next 6 to 9 months are going to look like as far as health, privacy, and security, HIT, and any thoughts you have on the 21st Century Cures Act, whatever that is and whatever it's going to do to our space?
Sure. Well, a couple of points I guess I want to make just in closing. I think the sort of what to do about non-HIPAA health data debate is going to build and get louder. And, you know, I do think there's a progression for how these issues work. I think what we're seeing is a building consensus that we need to do something to deal with what is now perceived as a real problem. We haven't yet gotten to a point where there is any consensus at all on what that solution is. But I think, you know, the first step is identifying that there's a problem, and I think that we're building to a pretty strong consensus on that. And I think that consensus is covering people all over the, you know, the spectrum on how the solutions might play out. So you have privacy advocates, you have businesses, you have industry, you have regulators, you have, you know, everybody realizes that's an issue. So that's one thing. And again, I don't think there's going to be a new law next week at all, but I think we have a building consensus on that. I think the 21st Century Cure bill that you mentioned, which is a massive bill that is largely designed to sort of reinvigorate how the FDA deals with drugs and how healthcare innovation gets in place faster and quicker, et cetera, et cetera. That bill has a bunch of privacy implications that very few people are either aware of or understand. And those implications potentially are very significant. One is I personally think the provisions that are in there now are very troubling from a privacy perspective. At the same time, if that bill gets passed, and it's already passed the House, and it passed the House pretty easily, the way those provisions are written, they will force HHS to go back and reopen the HIPAA rules to deal with the provisions from 21st century. And I think at that point, there's at least a realistic possibility that they start doing other stuff as well. And so that could be a real wild card in terms of whether we're going to have some significant change to the structure. Now, I don't think HHS can fix that HIPAA gap problem, because the whole reason we have the HIPAA gap is HHS has limited jurisdiction, and nothing in any bill that's out there now is going to let them, you know, turn HIPAA into a true medical privacy rule. But I do think they could, you know, again, people spent a lot of time and energy dealing with the changes from high tech, which were frankly relatively modest, for at least the covered entities. There were obviously bigger implications for the service provider, business associate community. But I think that if HHS starts down that path, first of all, it won't be fast, because they're not fast on writing these regulations, but I think it could be dramatic in a, you know, 2 to 4 year term, not obviously next month or next year.
And that was this week's The Week in Health Law. A very special thank you to Kirk Nara. Kirk can be found on Twitter at KIRKJNAHRAWORK. Thank you so much for joining us, Kirk.
Thank you for having me.
We post our show notes at twill.com. Also at twill.com, you can see a link to our crowdfunding page if you'd like to support the show. Also new this week, if you're in a generous mood, you can buy yourself a Twill t-shirt from that page through Amazon. So another way you can support our show. You can contact me at Nicholas Terry on Twitter. And Frank?
I am at HealthPI, HealthPI on Twitter.
Thank you for joining us, and have a legally interesting but healthy week.